It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. David Brooks and E.J. Dionne disagree with each other for a living. Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times, generally with a conservative view of things. Dionne writes for the Washington Post, typically with a liberal bent. The two appear regularly on NPR's All Things Considered and offer their analysis of the week's events. But despite their often differing take on politics, the two are more than cordial to each other. They are friends who manage to disagree without raising their voices in anger to each other. That relationship made them the ideal speakers at the gala dinner for the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, which was marking, in its words, a century of civility. I had a chance to interview them on stage at that event. We talked about Wisconsin's place in national politics, but also how they're able to maintain a friendship amid political disagreement. David Brooks answered first.
Well, we actually secretly hate each other, but we're good actors. I have a rule of who I'll be on with. I'm on NPR with EJ, and I'm on a show called The NewsHour on PBS with Mark Shields. So I appear only with Catholics from Massachusetts, and that works for me. EJ and I have been long friends. Mark and I have been long friends. Mark has been doing the NewsHour for a long time now. Our segment is called Shields and Brooks. We wanted to call it Brooks Shields, but they wouldn't allow that. And before that, it was Shields and Chigo and Shields and Gergen. And then before that, it was Shields and Coolidge. And it started out as Shields and Thomas Aquinas, I think. And EJ and I have known each other for a long time. And we met, well, probably through work, but we have a lot in common. Baseball. We both have sons who played pretty serious baseball, and we used to commune over that. We're similar height. That's important. I'm not sure how. Mostly it's just, when you're going to argue with somebody, first you want to like them. You want to have a relationship. And then you want to, I used to be a liberal, and I can talk about why I came to my senses later. But you want to have some respect and know that politics is basically a competition between half-truths. And each side probably has a piece of it. My side is just a little larger.
E.J. Dionne.
David and I both love Theodore Roosevelt. David loves him because he's a conservative. I love him because he's a progressive, which probably proves that both of us are wrong. I think I honor the Gill family in the room, and it does reflect the fact this organization reflects something that doesn't happen that much, and it's something David and I talk about. Which is facts matter in public policy, but they don't seem to matter so much in the debate right now. And I think David and I sort of share a sense that at least we ought to share, some sort of basic agreement on what the facts are, and then we can beat each other's heads in. I grew up actually in a conservative family, although my family became more liberal over time. I once inscribed a book to David's mother which said, who raised a wonderful son and has much better politics than he does. But I always like to say that I grew up in a very argumentative extended family. And so I can literally say I deeply loved people I passionately disagreed with. And you don't have that much. And one of the favorite things that's happened to me is I had a dear Uncle Ray, and he and I spent 35 years arguing about politics. And his kids, my cousins, were kind enough to ask me to do the eulogy. And I made a point in the eulogy of quoting Richard Nixon. And it was a Nixon quote I actually liked, but I looked at the people in the room and said, the other reason I quoted Nixon is because I was hoping Uncle Ray would come back to life, rise up out of the casket, and point to me and say, I knew you'd be quoting Nixon someday. And I just think that there is a sort of an odd degree of hatred in our politics now. And look, I can get very polemical and I can get angry myself, so I don't pretend to be an angel on any of these things. But there is just something about not understanding the possibility that somebody might have a different view from you. And I think that's sort of what brings David and me together, even though he's wrong on most things.
Well, and you talk about friendship, and you talk about youth baseball, and I wonder if you're onto something here. Not everyone has kids in youth sports, but at the heart of things, there are commonalities that tie us together that are maybe overlooked. We tend to think of each other as proxies for liberal or conservative, and not proxy for woodworker or jogger or bowler. I mean, is there something about not even being interested in getting to know each other anymore?
Yeah. Could I just say real quick on that? One of the things, one of the
it's
issues.
It's already interrupting me.
Yeah. One of the issues I think we most agree on, we both share an interest in community. We discovered maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that we both liked a conservative writer called Robert Nisbet, who wrote a book called The Quest for Community. And David's politics are closer to Nisbet's politics than mine are, but there is this sense that, communitarianism, it's not a great word, but it's a great idea. And I think that David has a communitarian streak in his conservatism, and I have a communitarian streak in my liberalism. Go ahead, David.
Having most of us in the course of our lives have shifted, so you're aware of other positions because you used to hold them. As EJ mentioned, my parents were not quite, but pretty left-wing. And I remember in 1965, they took me to this be-in. I've told this story. EJ's probably heard it. I was five. A be-in was where hippies would go just to be in New York. And
most of this audience experienced that.
They'll probably, if you were in Madison, I guarantee it. The hippies took their wallets out and they threw it into a burning trash can. And to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was 5 years old, and I saw a $5 bill on fire in the trash can. So I broke from the crowd, reached into the fire, grabbed the money, and ran away. And that was my first step over to the right. But it took a little while. And I actually am, I should say, since EJ's currying local favor, I am a member of one completely socialist organization. I am a co-owner of the Green Bay Packers. But I would say one thing to just your question. Tom Wolfe was once asked, what's the most important thing that happened in your lifetime? And he said, oh, that's easy, co-ed dorms. And I think what he meant by that was that the decisions politicians make have huge effects on how we live. But the most important effects are changes in community, changes in morality, changes in attitudes. It's about sociology and psychology and romance. And if you take politics as a small piece of life, then it's hard to have an absolutist hatred towards somebody when you probably share things in these other realms.
Well, let's talk specifically about Wisconsin, which I think we can agree has been the model of civility. This state, along with Ohio and Indiana to a degree, has been at the leading edge of what seems to be a growing political will to take on public workers and public worker unions. First of all, what do you see as the ripple effect nationally from the politics that has played out in Wisconsin, particularly since Scott Walker became governor?
Go ahead, David.
EJ wants the rebuttal position on this one. One of the things that's been striking to me is that we, each generation has an incentive to spend money on itself and make promises to itself and push the costs onto future generations. And no generation has done it to the extent that we have. And I have theories about that or why we've done that, but in two ways we've made huge spending on ourselves, huge promises to ourselves, and pushed the costs on others. And that's through deficit spending on the federal level, and that's often through states' pension spending on the local level. And so to me, that is a legitimate big problem. It is also a problem that is going to take decades to get out from under. And therefore, as you're doing the problem, solving it, you have to acknowledge that the other party exists. And you have to find a way to respect that they are going to exist, that they're going to be in power, and that if you're going to try to set a series of bipartisan policies, you have to acknowledge you want some continuity from party to party. So you have to think in terms of bipartisanship. So I totally understood why Walker went after some of these issues. I think it's essential for governance in the future. It's going to be essential in Illinois. It's essential in California, state after state. You have to go after these unaffordable pensions, which are just sucking up money from everything else. But where I differed from the approach I saw here was that you got to create a long system that's going to work across parties, and I thought he was needlessly confrontational.
E.J. Dionne, is it that it's a problem at all, or is it the aim that was taken to the problem?
Well, I think you can sort of sense some of the differences in the way David and I look at the world by where he began his discussion, which is that the central problem is with the deficits and looking to the next generation. And I think the central problem for the next generation is the lack of economic growth and the rise of a kind of radical inequality where we have gone back after a period of narrowing inequalities, a long period of narrowing inequalities in our country. Inequality has grown steadily since 1973, and we became, we were about as unequal on the eve of this great recession as we were on the eve of the Great Depression. I don't think that's entirely accidental. Therefore, look at what happened here in Wisconsin, my view of unions is fundamentally positive. Because I think when you look at how we became a great middle-class nation, unions played a very large role in that. They played a very large role in guaranteeing a decent level of life for people who worked in blue-collar jobs. And so I had an instinctive reaction against the direct frontal attack on unions. I would agree with David, for example, that pension costs are a problem for a lot of states. I think the real cause of that is that a lot of politicians found it easier to put money in pensions that were hidden in the future than to give public employees direct raises, and that was a problem in both parties, and now we have to come to terms with that. But when you look at Wisconsin, as if I'm right, the Bill 10 excluded cops and firefighters. And here in Milwaukee, I think 68-69% of pension costs are in for police and fire. And I honor police and firefighters, but that seems more political than it does a real attack on the problem. And the politicians I admired in the downturn were the ones who, A, were willing to make cuts necessary, but also willing to raise taxes because they didn't want to do it all in cuts. Rather than simply go at spending. And I think it's a job of politicians to negotiate with public employees rather than to try to take them on by force. And so I found, I would have been clearly on the other side of this fight here in Wisconsin.
The fight vaulted the former Milwaukee County executive turned governor onto the national political stage. Many are describing him as a national political contender now. What is your assessment of where Scott Walker falls in the Republican presidential or potentially vice presidential field in 2016?
I think it's not out of the question in the sense that he does have a lot of sympathy on the Republican right. Just the enemy or your enemy is your friends, and a lot of people on the right these days dislike unions. I also think that some of it will depend on the mood of the party because a certain amount of a kind of confrontational right that has not seemed to help them in presidential elections. And, another thing I find curious that I've learned about is, this effort to have state law tell localities that they have to get rid of their residency requirements. It just seems odd for a conservative to tell Brown Deer or Milwaukee or La Crosse that they can't do something that was traditionally allowed and, not to mention taking those property taxes out for people who collect public pensions. And so I think, when you're governor, I picked that one issue. Being governor is great preparation for a presidential campaign. It can also be disastrous because you've got to defend an entire record. And Mitt Romney couldn't defend his greatest achievement as governor. He should have embraced health care in Massachusetts, and he couldn't. So there's a real challenge these days, and I think some of it is the media environment, to being a governor and going on the national stage.
Yeah. David, I would say it's harder to be – I mean, to get the nomination, it's easier to be a governor. I mean, between John Kennedy and Barack Obama, 61 senators ran for president, and their record was 0-61. And I used to tease them, why do you guys all lose? And they would say, well, we take tough votes. But the reality was, and this was given to me by one of the senators who ran for president, is We're United States senators. We don't like staying in the Motel 6 in Pocahontas, Iowa. And they're sort of puffed up and distant. And if you're a mayor or a governor, you actually do talk about issues that are concrete and real. And so I still think governors have an advantage. Nonetheless, when I look at the political, the presidential candidates at this early stage, I just look at them like a baseball, a pitching scout. You just look at their stuff. Who throws the best fastball? Who throws the best curveball? Who has the best speaking style? Who has the most charisma? Who's best one-on-one? And so my exterior view, and I've met Walker a few times, is that he doesn't have as good stuff as a lot of the others. Marco Rubio seems to be a better politician. Paul Ryan seems to be a better politician. Just who's good? And I would put him in the middle of the pack.
Maybe he could reinvent himself as a knuckleballer, though.
We have a lot of knuckleheads. I don't know if we
Let me ask this question, speaking of the economy. As sequestration's effects find their way further and further into people's lives, who stands to pay a political price as we head toward the midterm elections?
First of all, the biggest problem with sequestration, there was a very good piece in the New York Times today on how foolish the policies we are now following are. The Times piece, if you didn't see it, said that austerity, kind of pulling back at this moment, has probably bumped the unemployment rate up by close to a full point. That's a lot of people without work who don't have to be without work. We're not out of the woods yet on the economic crisis. We are growing. It's better than it was. But we should be doing all we can to speed growth along. There's a time to address deficits, but it's not when you're still coming out of an economic mess. And the sequester just contributes to that, and not to mention creating particular problems. And I found it disturbing that, the flight delays hurt people who can afford plane tickets, so we'll fix that. But we're not going to fix Meals on Wheels, and we're not going to fix cutting Head Start, and we're not going to fix the cut for the unemployed. There's just something fundamentally wrong with that. But whether you agree with that or not, even if you don't agree with that, the policy of cutting at this moment is just a terrible idea. The problem is, I don't know if there is going to be a big price paid, because I think the Republicans, they believe in cuts, and they made a calculation that in the end, a slowing economy is likely to hurt the president and therefore the Democrats. And I think a lot depends on how these issues are argued between now and then. The president, I think he's got to bring us back to the larger debate over what it takes to build an economy. And some of that does involve, and I know I'm not using it as a euphemism for spending, investment. Including investment in infrastructure for the long haul. That's one issue David and I actually agree on. And so I think a lot depends on how the issue is framed.
Well, here's where we disagree. We've been borrowing $1 trillion a year plus for 5 years now. We're still borrowing close to $1 trillion a year. If this was austerity, I don't know what non-austerity looks like. We're just borrowing a lot of money.
Except the deficit is down much lower than that now.
Yeah, we're still, historically, the deficits are hugely high. And so I think if you take a look at the growth levels and the spending levels, there's really little correlation. Obviously, government spending creates some growth. I think the effect of that is remarkably weak and depends a lot on the psychology of the country at any given time. I think the sequester is too small an effect to have much an effect on economic growth in an economy, whatever it is, a $14 trillion economy. Nonetheless, I hate the sequester. It was designed to be stupid policy, and this is one thing Washington did magnificently with stupid policy. And I hate it because it does none of what you want. I mean, to me, what I want to do, and let's talk about something E.J. mentioned earlier tonight, which is he mentioned the inequality, and I agree that is a gigantic problem. I think we have two gigantic problems facing the country on the economic front. One is the rising inequality across educational lines. One is rising debt. And so to me, the way you deal with both those problems simultaneously is spend a lot more on discretionary spending now, on Head Start, on infrastructure, on early childhood programs, on all sorts of job training programs, and then do entitlement reform by means testing Medicare and other things over the long term. In other words, we have a government that's a giant machine for taking money from struggling families and giving it to affluent seniors. And what we should do is have a whole series of policies to take money from affluent seniors and give it to struggling families. And so to me, you can sort of solve both those problems. The sequester magnificently does the opposite. It cuts all the domestic programs that go to struggling families. It doesn't touch Medicare, basically. And so it hurts all the wrong people. It helps all the wrong people. And it makes our government much more like the kind of government you would have if your nation is in decline, spending on the present and not on the future.
First of all, I just want to go back, David, on one thing. I mean, broadly, I am sympathetic to the idea of transferring some resources from the wealthy to families who need them. I think that there's this notion that if there are all of these millionaires hanging around in country clubs collecting Medicare and Social Security, most of the spending on the elderly goes to elderly people who really need it. And a lot of the problem is not the elderly, it's rising health care costs. And, you know, the good news there is we may actually be succeeding in bringing down health care costs for the longer term. And if we can do that, a lot of these other problems become much easier to solve. But I, again, this is probably an area where David and I disagree. I think that there are some savings to be had in those programs, but I don't think they're as great as David says because there just aren't that many rich elderly people to take this money from.
As much as it pains me to say this, the time has flown by, and more of it has flown by than initially planned. But before we wrap up, please let's give a warm round of applause and thanks to David Brooks of EJDN.
Thank you.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times. E.J. Dionne writes for The Washington Post. Both are regular pundits on NPR's All Things Considered. They were the featured speakers at the Public Policy Forum's 100th anniversary gala dinner last week, where our interview was recorded. You can hear more of the conversation at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. A quick break now, and in just a moment, writer Michael Pollan on why the local foods movement requires a revolution not just in the grocery store, but in the kitchen as well. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.